And so we've actually been asking a question for the last number of weeks. What would it look like to start over with the Christian faith? Where would we begin? What's the adult starting point for the Christian faith? That's where we've been. I think we're in week four. And so if you're here this morning or you're in person or you're online, you may want to go back and listen to the sort of the teachings that kind of went before, because they're gonna certainly get, they'll certainly help you get a sense of where we are now. Even though I'm hoping to fill in some blanks this morning, but I think it would give you a sense of context. And if you have questions, you know there's a form that you can fill out at the back that just says, and any and all questions are great, they're game. You can fill it out in person or online, and we'll try to answer them as best we can over the next number of weeks. So here's something you may or may not have considered, but the story of religious faith actually has a starting point. The story of religious faith has a starting point. Every major faith tradition, and I'm talking about Judaism, Islam, Christianity, maybe you were brought up in one of those faith traditions or some kind of a spin-off of one, but every one of them has a story behind it. Each one of them has history. But maybe, like you remember in high school, you weren't very interested in history. And when it comes to faith or God or our questions, you know, we care less about how did my faith tradition begin, but does it work? Will it help me now? It's Thursday, and I've been asking God for, you know, fill in the blank since Sunday. And where is God when I really need him, right? I have a test tomorrow, and I really need to know. I want to know, what can God do for me right now? I don't really care about the history. And maybe for some, the reason that we might have drifted away from faith was because we just didn't know the history of it. And so what I want to do this morning is I want to look at something really important that happened a long time ago, and I want to tie it together with maybe something that you've struggled with in your faith journey and your faith experience, so that you can factor that in as you consider the question, who is Jesus? Maybe some of you knew this, but centuries ago, all right, the three largest religious faith traditions all had the same starting point. Islam, Christianity, and Judaism all had the very same starting point. All three believe in a single God, an all-powerful creator that created the heavens and the earth. They believe that this God, and goes by different names, but essentially all the same, created the first man on earth, the first humans, and the first man's name was Adam, and the first woman's name was Eve. And actually, Muhammad taught that Adam was the first Muslim, or the first prophet. Judaism believed Adam and Eve were the first humans. And Christians also take the story of Adam and Eve very seriously, but not necessarily because it's found in the book of Genesis, but because Jesus himself talked about Adam and referenced Adam. So all three of those major religious faith traditions all share those beliefs. And they also share the belief that somehow humanity messed up what God had created. God created this perfect world, and humanity messed it up. Now, if you're here this morning and you might not believe the Adam and Eve story, and that's okay. You might believe it's a myth, or you might believe that it's just there to explain sort of human behavior or whatnot. But here's what we could all agree on. Humans have messed things up. We have messed up the world. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about this. We said that sin, that's the word that we use, it's the word that's used, has ruined every relationship that humanity has had. We became separated from God because of our sin, because of our rebellion. And God's the most important relationship. And as a result of that being messed up, we're separated. We're at odds with God. And therefore, we're at odds with who we are within ourselves. And we're at odds, or we're separated from other people and the world around us. This oneness that we were created to have and enjoy with God became otherness. And all the major religious faiths believe that. And the other thing that all the other faith traditions come together on is a single man. They believe that God interacted with one man, and through this one man, God began to correct what humanity had messed up. And now I know some of you are thinking, oh, this one's an easy, it's Jesus, right? Well, that's a great thought, but actually, this man's name is Abraham. Abraham is where all three major religious faith traditions come together. It's also the person that all three major religious faith traditions separate on. With Abraham, Islam goes in one direction, Judaism goes in another, and centuries later, Christianity goes in, which is an offshoot of Judaism, goes in a completely different direction. But they all look back to Abraham, where God began to strategically intersect with humanity to fix the problem of sin and otherness in the world. And here's why this is important. It's not just history. Here's why it's important, because there's this conversation that we're going to read. It's recorded in the book of Genesis between God and Abraham. And regardless of whether you believe, you know, the Bible to be true, and regardless of where you are in your faith, this conversation touches on this tension that you and I have definitely felt and wrestled with on our faith journey. Maybe some of you here today. And the tension is this: if there is a God, how am I doing with him? Does he care about me? And can I ever have a sense of comfort or peace and security about the future? How do I know where I stand with God? And in this conversation that we're going to see in just a minute, there's this little statement that is so powerful and so hope-filled. And it's for all of us, for all humanity, as we consider, particularly for us this morning, as we consider the Christian faith, because Abraham is not just a historical figure. There's an Abraham and you and me component or side of this story. Now, to get to the connection between Abraham and us, I want to kind of tell share a story that has a bit of a much more of a modern context for the situation that God was in and why he engaged with a man named Abraham. This story happened in my life. It happened about 20 years ago, and it is a vivid memory. We had bought a house in Brampton, and we'd sold the house that we were living in, and there was going to be this gap, and so we needed to move in with, my mom was gracious to allow us to move in with her for a few months, but we needed to put our stuff somewhere, so we were planning to rent a storage unit. And a friend of ours that was at the church that I was serving with at the time, his name was John, he had a really large house. I might say mansion, but he had a really large house, and he had a completely unfinished basement, and he said, hey, listen, to save you some money, we could leave our stuff there, we could put it there, which was a really very gracious offer, and so we took him up on it. So we rented a truck, and my brother and I, on the day that we moved, we loaded up, some of our stuff, and we made the first trip, and he's a very nice house. We're very conscious, you know, not to scrape any walls, getting things down to the basement, and just leave everything as beautiful as it was when we found it. And so we make the first trip. And you know, when you're loading up a truck, if you've ever moved, the first trip, you are like meticulous. Like you are Tetrising everything together just to make sure you don't have to make more than one trip. Well, we had to make more than one trip. And so it's getting near the end of the day. It's around 6 o'clock, we're making that second trip, and we probably weren't that careful in how we loaded things up the second trip, right? You're just kind of like, just get it in and get it done. And we're tired, we just want it to be done, and we're on the road, and we hit a pretty decent pothole in the road. And our moving truck bounced up, and when it came down, I heard this sound. Except in my mind, it went on a lot longer than that. A lot longer than that. And I'm thinking, and when you hear a sound like that, when you're in a moving truck, your brain's going all over the place. And I'm thinking, what could that possibly be? Except the sound of every piece of glass ever made breaking in the trunk or in the back of the truck. And I'm thinking, you know what? What could it possibly be? And I'm thinking, you know what? I think we left most of our pictures to the last run, because it's, you know, we could just sort of fit them in. I'm thinking, okay, worst case scenario, we're going to have to replace some frames. Now, we pull into John's driveway, and I'm already conscious. It's late in the day. We've already made one trip into his basement, and now we're back again, and I don't want to mess up his house. So we gingerly raise the back door of the truck, and you know when you're making popcorn and it just sort of comes out all over the place? Almost instantaneously, thousands of tiny pieces of broken glass come cascading down past me and all over John's interlock brick driveway. It wasn't picture frames that we heard. It was our glass patio table that had shattered into, and I'm not exaggerating, 100 billion pieces of glass. And it went all over the driveway. And my mind is racing at that moment. I'm thinking, John drives beautiful cars. We're not going to be able to get this cleaned up. And one piece is going to flatten his tire. And he's also an elder at our church. I'm probably getting fired for this. And all of these thoughts are spinning around in my mind. And I am ashamed to say this. That inner voice that's like a five-year-old kid in me at the time thought, let's just leave. Let's just drive away. We will get out of this mess this way. And John comes out, and he looks at us, and he points to us, and he says, you idiot. You moron. Look what you did to my driveway. How am I supposed to get my cars out of the garage? I mean, I can't believe that I told you that you could store your stuff here. Like, I'm eating dinner right now. You know what? Get this stuff cleaned up and call me when it's done. Now, here's the thing. Some of us think that's what God is like. That God stares at you in the middle of the mess that you made in, you know, your own sea of busted glass and with all the potential damage, and he says to you, you got to figure this out. I will be in there. And when you get it cleaned up, call me, right? Like, we have this idea that, you know, you got to clean up what you mess up. But even those of us who think that's kind of what God is like, most of you don't believe that my friend John said any of that, what he said, and just left us to clean up the mess, which means you think he's more compassionate than God is. That somehow he's more gracious than God. That somehow he's more glorious than God. Which he's not. Which means that there's something about God that you don't know. What John actually said to us was, don't move. Now, my first thought when I heard that was, he's a hunter, and I know it's much easier to shoot a target that is not moving, right? But he said, don't move. You're going to get glass embedded into your shoes. And so he went, and he got his shop vac, and for the next 20 minutes, he waded across this sea of broken glass, and he cleaned up our mess. He didn't create it. He was gracious to give us a place for our stuff, and he interrupts his dinner to wade into the mess that I created, and he cleaned it up. Now, in a similar way, humanity messes up this beautiful world that God gave us. And we certainly have experience, and we have injustice today, right? But back in the ancient world, we would have not even comprehended the kind of injustice that was there. Without a civil society and without law, everybody, we're told, did what was right in their own eyes. They did what was right to them. It was survival of the fittest and often survival of the richest. Slavery wasn't even a second thought. You wanted something, you just took them. And in this very chaotic world at the time, that would be so offensive to us in our postmodern thinking and sensibilities, God saw that sin had taken hold of humanity, and he could have easily just hung an out-of-order sign over the earth and gone and done something else, you know, somewhere else. But God is compassionate. And here's the thing. All three of the major faith traditions believe that God decided to wade into the mess that humanity had made and that he chose a man named Abraham to start with. So around 1800 BC, God engages humanity through Abraham. And Abraham is a super normal guy. He's not perfect. He's not super righteous at all. In fact, he's got some real issues. One time, he's going through Egypt with his wife, Sarah. And Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt, some of his servants see Sarah, and she's very beautiful. And they tell Pharaoh about her. that she's really, you know, really beautiful. And so Pharaoh says, go bring her to me. And so they went to Abraham and they said, is this your wife? And Abraham can see this coming. And he knew what would happen if he said yes, right? They would kill him and take her. And he did not appreciate that potential outcome. So Abraham, being the courageous man he was, says, well, she's not really my wife. She's my sister. Okay? Ooh. Ooh. But you can have her, he says. And he gave his wife to Pharaoh. Now, I'll just say this. You might think your partner has some issues, right? You know, but on a scale of Abraham to 10, you know, they're probably doing a lot better in your mind now after hearing that particular story, right? Abraham is the sort of the hero of this part of the story. And he's just so normal, but he's got lots of issues. But God had to start somewhere, and so he picks imperfect Abraham. And here's what God said to Abraham in the book of Genesis. It's found in Genesis 11 and 12. The Lord said to Abraham, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. Leave. In other words, I want you to leave your comfort zone. I want you to leave your neighborhood, your community, your circle of influence. And I realize you don't have any kids, and Sarah, by this point, is well advanced in years. And the prospects of her having children is very, very low at this point. But Abraham, I'm starting over, and I'm doing something new. And I'm going to do something that will, through you, that will impact the whole world. I'm going to start with you. And it's going to be difficult for you to understand. And then God makes three promises to Abraham. The first one, he says, I will make you into a great nation. And that came true. That came true. The nation of Israel would say, yeah, that's us. We're that nation. And actually, the Arab nations would say, no, we are those great nations. And there's certainly some discussion as to which nations are being talked about here, but we can recognize that many nations came from Abraham. This promise that God made to Abraham was made almost 4,000 years ago, and it absolutely came true. And so get this, God is addressing the issue of sin and corruption in the world. And he starts with a man, and he says to Abraham, I'm going to make you into a nation, which means first I'm going to make you into a family, and then into a nation. And probably at this point, Abraham is thinking, but wait a second, if you're wading into the world to correct this problem of sin, and you're going to start by making me a family and into a nation, that seems like it's going to take a long time. I mean, it's a little bit like calling 911, and they're like, we're on it. We just have to put the engine back together into the fire truck, and then we'll be there. Like, this is going to take a long period of time. God's saying, someday you're going to be a nation, and through that nation, I'm going to do something really, really great in the world. Promise number two, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great. And so let me just do a quick survey this morning. Put your hand up if before coming here this morning, you had heard of Abraham. Put your hand up. Yeah, look at that. That's almost everybody, right? It's not Abraham Lincoln, by the way, just in case some of you are kind of like, right? But most of us here have heard of Abraham. And isn't that amazing? Now think about this. Anybody heard of this guy? His name is Chedorlay Omar. He's not the Cheetos mascot. Chedorlay Omar is his name. Anybody ever heard of him before? If you have, put your hand up. Don't be afraid. Yeah, maybe a couple hands, maybe. Well, he was the king of Elam. Anybody heard of Elam before? Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore, right? He doesn't exist anymore. Most of us, actually pretty much everybody, nobody in this room had heard of Chedorlay Omar, but everybody in Abraham's day did. He was a king. But isn't it interesting that God says to Abraham, a virtual nobody, I'm going to make your name great. And 4,000 years later, in a different part of the world, in a different culture, with a different language, most of us have heard of Abraham. Yet another, at the time, is a well-known guy, a king of an entire land, and yet none of us have heard of him today. Promise number three. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you. All peoples, all people groups will be better off because of you. And the Muslims say, yeah, that's us, right? We're better off because of Abraham. And the Jewish people say, well, no, because of Abraham, we are better people, and the Jews have made the world a better place. And the Jewish nation has made the world a better place. And Christians say, no, he's talking about us, because there are so many good things that, as a result of Abraham, Christians have been sort of ingrafted in to that family, and there's so many things that we've been involved in, you know, education, charitable organizations, hospitals, like, we've made the world a better place, so the world's a better place because of our connection to Abraham. And to which God would say, well, that was actually my point, right? That all peoples in the world would be blessed through Abraham. Abraham has significant impact on our world, and all three major religions claim him to be theirs. Okay, so that's the historical part, but here's the personal part. At the time God makes these promises to Abraham, he's getting older. He has no children, and he realizes that if he dies without children, everything that he owns will go to Eliezer, is probably another name that you've not heard before. Eliezer was Abraham's sort of chief servant, his right-hand guy. And everything would go to him if Abraham doesn't have an heir. And Abraham is thinking, when he hears these promises from God, okay, you're going to make me into a great nation. I'm not sure what that is, but it sounds pretty big. Everybody on earth is going to be blessed, you know, through me. They're going to know my name. But you know what? I don't really care about being a nation. I just want to have a son. I just want a son. And so one night, Abraham is praying, and it's this prayer of desperation, which, you know, probably we might not identify with his words, but we can identify with the prayer of his heart. He's like, Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless? I don't have any children. I don't have a son. And my servant, Eliezer, is going to get everything that I own. And here's how the writer of Genesis writes what God says in response to this prayer to Abraham. No, your servant will not be your heir. You will have a son of your own who will be your heir, your own flesh and blood. And then God takes Abraham outside, and I think this is so cool. God takes him outside and he says to him, look up in the sky and count the stars if you can. Now, I know for some of us, maybe for most of us, you go outside your house at nighttime and you look up and you can see like 8 stars, right? Oh, and one of those is a plane, so 7 stars. So it doesn't really have that kind of meaning to us. But in this huge Middle Eastern sky where Abraham was, that stretched really from horizon to horizon without any kind of ambient light like we have to deal with, the sky is ablaze with stars. And God says, see all those stars? Count them if you can, but I know you can't. That's how many descendants you are going to have. I know you don't have a son. I know you don't have an heir, but Abraham, I want you to trust me. You're going to become a great nation. I know you're going to have a hard time trusting me, but there will be more people related to you than you can ever possibly count. And here is what I think is the amazing personal part for you and me. We read in Genesis a statement that is so powerful and so, I think, so personal, and it's so significant. Maybe some of you have read it before, or maybe some of you might be hearing this for the first time, but it's amazing to me that this statement survived 4,000 years, and it has so many implications for everyone, not just those in this room or online or across the world, but everyone, because in this statement, it's the first time that we can see sort of recorded that God is stating the nature of the relationship between humanity and himself. It's as if someone said, is it possible for someone as small and as finite as me to have a relationship with the creator of everything, the creator who is infinite and almighty? Maybe that's a question you've asked yourself at some point in your life. You're like, you know, can anybody know? Can I know where I stand with an invisible, powerful God? And with this next statement, God defines the terms between God and humanity. And this statement is so powerful, but it's also so divisive, because it's where Christianity, Islam, and Judaism all go in 3 different directions. And if I'm being honest, none of the 3 major religious traditions embrace this statement wholly without adding to it because it's so unbelievably simple. It seems too good to be true, right? This statement comes before the Ten Commandments. It comes before Moses. It's about 2,600 years before Islam and about 2,000 years before Jesus. And this is what is recorded for us. Abram, before his name was changed to Abraham, believed the Lord, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of his faith. Abraham believed the Lord, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of his faith. Abraham says, I've got no children. Chances of that happening seem to be slim and none. But God says, I will have descendants as numerous as the uncountable stars. Okay. I choose to trust you. And in that moment, in that wonderful, solitary, single expression of whatever faith Abraham had in that moment, God credited or God gave Abraham a righteous standing with God. In that single moment, God said to Abraham, in this sea of the brokenness of sin and rebellion, I'm giving you the gift of a right standing with me. I'm not holding your past against you. I'm not holding your future against you. You know that little incident with your wife and Pharaoh? Yeah, super embarrassing, but we're not going to go there. Abraham, I accept you because you believed me. You put your trust in me. Another way of saying that is trusting God resulted in a right standing with God. And this is the first sort of recorded indication that a human being can have a right standing with God. And how did it happen? Not because of anything Abraham did. It was because Abraham took God at his word. Faith, he trusted God. And here's what I think is interesting. Years would go by, and then the Jewish people would say, no, you know, the way that you have a right standing with God is by being Jewish, right? We're God's chosen people. In fact, a couple thousand years would go by, and when Jesus showed up, they said, you know, we don't need you. We're Abraham's sons and daughters. That's all we need. It's enough to be a child of Abraham to be right with God. And if anybody else, if the Gentiles want to be right with God, then they need to become Jewish, right? And then you can be grafted into the family tree. And then you can be Abraham's sons and daughters. It's all about who you are related to. It's about birth. And then centuries would go by, like some about 600 years after Jesus, and the prophet Muhammad would come along, and he would say, no, the way you have a right standing with God is you must believe in the one true God and believe in his prophet, and you must do works and acts of righteousness. And at the end of your life, Allah will measure your good works against your bad and determine if you have a right standing. You won't know until the end. You won't know. But it's what you believe and what you do that counts. And then what seemed like the next day after Jesus left the earth, Christians started talking and arguing about this. And one group said, well, you know, Gentiles need to become Jewish, and the men would have to have surgery, and then they'd have to keep the law of Moses. And then another group said, well, they can't keep the law of Moses. They don't know what the law of Moses is. And another group said, I think you just need to believe. And others said, no, believing is too simple. And then right on through, and including the Reformation, the church has been sort of divided over this issue of how do you have a right standing with God? How do you know when God says you're approved? And how do you know when you've done enough or you've believed enough? How do you know and can you know? Is it birth? Is it behavior? Is it belief? Is it a combination of two out of three of those kinds of things? And 4,000 years before any of those religions existed, before anyone was, anyone considered themselves Jewish or Muslim or Christian, God showed Abraham and us the truth about a relationship with him. And it is hard. It's hard to comprehend that the Most High God, the creator of everything, would make the standard so simple. The Most High God who saw each of us in a sea of broken glass, a mess that we made, and that's the word sin describes that mess. He would see us and we wonder, can we call on him to help us? And that very same God said, the way you enter into a relationship with me, where I call you righteous and approved, is not through who you're related to. It's not through your behavior. It's trust. Will you choose to trust me? Will you simply say, as Abraham did, and as hard as it might be to believe, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust that what you said is true and that you'll do what you promised to do. And centuries later, we read the Apostle Paul, one of the great missionaries who started out as an anti-Christian and became a follower of Jesus, said this, therefore, nobody will be declared righteous in God's sight by works of the law, doing what the religious law said to do. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God, the right standing of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets were all pointing to, or they testify. This righteousness, or this right standing, is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. Paul said there's no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are justified, or that means all are given a right standing freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Jesus, by Christ Jesus. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement to make it one through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. God made it so simple. And we talked a little bit about this a few weeks back. The starting point for a relationship with God, the starting point for faith is a question. The Christian faith is a question. Who is Jesus? And then the starting point for a relationship, and this is, I'm asking this question, what if the starting point for a relationship with God is trusting him? What if the starting point for the Christian faith is a question, who is Jesus? And then the starting point for a relationship with God is trusting him. Trusting him about our situation, trusting him for his redemption, his salvation. What if what we saw with Abraham, where God decided to wade into the sea of glass and said, I'm going to do something, and I'm picking one unrighteous man, and I'm going to engage with Abraham in a personal way, and all I require is that he say, God, I trust you. What if that's it? Would that not be the very definition of grace? I know this is hard. It's hard for many of us because maybe the way that you were raised, you know, we were told that faith is foundational, but to be accepted by God, it's faith plus, right? It's faith plus works, right? There's no other place in the world, though, where you can be unconditionally loved and accepted simply based on trust. It didn't happen at school. It doesn't happen at work. Unfortunately, maybe for some, it didn't happen at church either. But yet when we go back pre-Judaism, pre-Islam, pre-Christianity, and find that one man that they all want to embrace and take credit for, God said to that man, Abraham, I declare you righteous because you trusted me. What if the starting point for our acceptance by God and a relationship with him is as simple as trusting him? As we close, here's a little bit of homework for you to consider. And to have a courageous conversation with yourself. Maybe you can have this conversation with somebody else that you trust. Which of the following reflects your personal and practical view on how you relate to God? God accepts me based on my birth, right? It's through who you're related to. Or God accepts me based on my behavior. It's what I'm able to do. Or God accepts me based on trust, belief. Or do you think it's a combination of two or three? Which model did you sort of grow up with? Or which model do you kind of intentionally or maybe unintentionally lean into? And think about this on an emotional level. Can you accept the idea that even though God is so big, But his love and his grace are so stunning and so different that all you need to do is just trust. Just accept what he has said and trust with whatever amount of trust you have. That's one of the reasons why in this series we're saying, let's fix our eyes, our focus, our eyes on Jesus, our thoughts on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, because our faith cannot be perfected by the way in which we live it out, but we fix our eyes on what Jesus has done. And that leads us, you know, we ask the question, who is Jesus? And what has he done? And we trust that what has been done for us, and we just simply trust God at his word. Let's pray. Father God, we thank you that you loved your creation in spite of the fact that we took your beautiful gift and we messed it up because we wanted to be in charge. We wanted to be in control. We wanted to have freedom without any strings. And Lord, your desire for us was never that we have that because we couldn't stand up under the weight of that responsibility. And your desire was always that you would be a loving Father who would walk alongside us and tell us who we are and give us an identity. And Father, that you didn't abandon us when we turned from you and ran the other direction, saying, we'll listen to all these other voices who will tell us what we want to hear. And that, Lord, you didn't turn your back on us. You waded into that mess at the greatest personal cost. You showed us through Abraham that you weren't going to require anything except that trust. And the cost of Jesus, your son, paid the price so that we could be adopted by faith. It's your grace that we receive by faith. And Father, for each of us here, Lord, the simplicity of a relationship with you, it seems so much easier to make it more difficult, to make it more about what I can do, and that's just us retaking control again. And you've just said, let go of those things, let down those prizes, the things that you bring that you think I need, and you've just said, I want to embrace you, just trust me. Lord, would you break through the hard shell that we've maybe protected ourselves with, that it's not as simple as that, and Lord, that we would look to Abraham's just simple confession, okay, Lord, and that's what brings us into a right standing with you, because we take your word, we take you at your word, we see what you've done through Jesus. Father, would you just, for those of us whose hearts are just, they're so tough because we've defended ourselves for so long, we've rationalized why it's this and not this, would you please, just through your grace, just break through that, through your Holy Spirit. Whisper in our ears that's all we need to do, is just reach out and take hold of the arms that have been extended for centuries, for millennia. And let us fall into those arms. Let us trust. And I ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.